Hey everyone, welcome to the Squanch Wisecracks Rick and Morty podcast. My name is Jared. I'm joined here by our Squanchers. We got Ryan.
Wubba lubba fuck yeah.
And returning again is Dr. Nihilism Michael Burns.
Hey.
Do you mind that nickname?
I don't dislike it. I don't actively like it in any way, okay. Shape, or form.
All right. Well, you know, as soon as people get to know you, then we can kind of like, yeah. You know, people like, oh, Michael Burns, Dr. Nihilism.
That's fair enough.
Anyway, before we get into it, I want to first tell you guys about Wisecrack Plus. So if you haven't heard of it, Wisecrack Plus is our awesome new membership service. So as a member, you get early ad-free versions of all our content, plus weekly member exclusives, including in-depth interviews with the writers and researchers. So for example, we have a full interview, hour-long interview up with Dr. Nihilism Michael Burns here because he wrote our most recent Rick and Morty video on nihilism in BoJack and Rick and Morty. We've got access to our full library of scripts and all of our research documents. We've got a member only Discord chat server, opportunities to participate in our podcasts like this one here, and exclusive Wisecrack merch every quarter and a whole lot more. So to learn more about Wisecrack Plus and join the club, go over to wisecrackplus.com. One more thing before we get into the show. If you're listening to The Squanch, it would really help us a lot to please take a minute and to fill out our listener survey using the link in the description of today's podcast. So it helps us give our advertisers and partners a better sense of who's listening and actually make sure we're able to provide special offers and promos that actually match your interests. We are an ad-supported business, and obviously we want to have you guys listen to ads that at least are semi-relevant to your life. So that's it. Thanks, guys, for listening, and now on with the show. So today we are covering Season 1, Episode 6 of Rick and Morty, entitled Rick Potion Number 9. So we skipped Season 1, Episode 5, Me Seeks and Destroy, because we did that right after the end of Season 3 when we went over mine, Ryan, and Alex's favorite episodes. And Me Seeks and Destroy was Alex's favorite episode, so we already went over that one. So now we're focusing on Season 1, Episode 6, Rick Potion Number 9. So let's go ahead and get some first impressions. Ryan, let's start with you. How do you feel about this episode after revisiting it?
I love it. A++, 100% out of 100.
Mm-hmm.
The weird thing about this episode, I haven't watched it that many times since the first time I ever watched Rick and Morty, but I mean, this is where the show really changes in a very stark way. And this the last fucking 5-10 minutes of this episode like transcend cartoons, I would say, and take you to a different place. And it's hard to really even pinpoint, but like, man, when the first time I saw it, and even this time, I get chills at the end when Morty is going into his house in his new dimension, and you're just, it really is an amazing thing that this cartoon did in this episode. I feel like the rest of the episode's okay. I mean, I laugh, but it's not any better or worse than your normal Rick and Morty episode, I'd say. But like, yeah, that last part, the big twist, it's like, whoa, this is awesome.
Absolutely. Michael, what about you?
Oh, it's so good. I hadn't watched this one since I'd watched it the first time, I think. So I actually forgot what was coming.
Oh, cool.
So it was great because with like 15 minutes in, I was like, oh, this episode's all right, but lacking a little bit. And then even when like they go back to the garage, I was like, they didn't even explain how they solved it. And then I was like, oh shit, it's that episode.
Yeah.
And I totally agree with Ryan. Like, it's definitely the episode. And I remembered this going back to the first time I watched it, where you realize the show is on like another level in terms of the places they're going to go and the like darkness of the emotions they're going to explore.
Yeah.
It was so good.
Yeah, so good. I think this is the episode that definitely set the tone for the rest of the series. I'm wondering if they, while writing it, were just kind of like stumbled upon something and just kept getting darker and darker. And they're like, are we really going to do this? Fuck yeah, we are. But yeah, no, same thing with me. I love this episode. There are also a lot of jokes that I didn't quite remember that were actually had me laughing this time.
Oh,
because
my God, yes.
Yeah, similar to Ryan, I find myself, obviously it's important to remember this episode just in terms of keeping up with the Rick and Morty lore, and also one of the darkest moments, and we talked about in some of our videos, the whole cosmic horror angle, and I think that this is, and even with nihilism, I think this is an essential episode in that discussion. But yeah, it's wild. And the one plot that I don't really remember at all that I actually found really fulfilling was the whole subplot with Beth and Jerry's marriage.
Yeah. You
know? Especially since with season three, we see how Beth and Jerry's marriage is such a focal point. I feel like one of the most fulfilling arcs about their marriage is in this episode, but no one ever really talks about it.
Yeah, that's a good point, because every episode from this is the sixth episode, but then every episode after this, you know, every time that Jerry is being just a little bitch, it's kind of like, well, you know what? In another dimension, he's a badass.
Yeah.
You know, the real dimension that we left. So what does that tell you?
And we see that happen. And then we see him again in season three, episode one, the Rick Shank redemption. And I just want to see more of him. I actually want to see more of this Cronenberg dimension entirely. But anyway, so let me go into a quick recap of the episode. So the annual flu season dance is coming and Morty is pining for Jessica. So he goes to Jerry for girl advice, but as Rick points out, Jerry's marriage isn't going so hot either. Beth is pretty tired of him being an unemployed schlub. So on Morty's request, Rick makes a love potion to use on Jessica that should be foolproof, unless someone has the flu. Morty successfully infects Jessica with the love potion, but she has the flu and spreads the insatiable lust for Morty to the entire school. Rick rescues Morty from the love mob and administers an antidote that goes horribly wrong, turning the entire planet into praying mantis monsters. Concerned that Beth might be cheating on him with her much sexier coworker, Davin, Jerry shoots his way through a freeway of mantis mutants and saves Beth from a mutated Morty-crazed Davin. The whole mutant takeover ordeal has made Jerry drop the sad sack act and start acting like a badass. Rick tries once more to cure the planet, but his newest antidote just turns them into more horrific and grotesque abominations he now dubs Cronenbergs. Beth and Jerry plow through monster after monster, find Summer, and realize that their new life in the post-apocalypse has put a new spark in their marriage. After Rick and Morty finish blaming each other for the living nightmare they've created, Rick unveils his emergency plan that will put everything back to, quote, relative normalcy. So in a parallel dimension where Rick's serum actually worked, Rick and Morty are killed in an explosive laboratory accident. Rick and Morty from the Cronenberg universe enter, bury their bodies, and assume their identities. Morty is devastated, but sure enough, things are relatively back to normal, including Beth and Jerry's marriage back to its shitty state. Back in the universe they left behind, and this is the post-credits, Beth is finally happy in her marriage, and Cronenberg Rick and Morty from another dimension in which everyone was always Cronenbergs but then were changed into normal people find comfort in the newly formed Cronenberg world. End of episode. So let's talk a little bit more about cosmic horror and how this episode is really a jump off the deep end of darkness for the show, and whether or not this episode set the tone for the rest of the show. I really think that they took the premise of the show in terms of a scientist who explores multiple dimensions and took it to one of its most horrific conclusions in this episode. And I think in this episode, after this episode, we not only look at the character of Rick in a new light, but the way that the world of Rick and Morty works entirely. So, I wanted to hear, especially, I guess, from you, Michael, just how is this the darkest thing that's ever happened in a Rick and Morty episode, do you think?
Like, I don't have a recall for every episode ever. It's fucking dark.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting how at the beginning of the episode, the way Rick talks about love sets up one vision of nihilism, like this reductive thing in which love is just a chemical reaction.
That compels animals to breed.
Yeah, which is dark enough in a very literal sense. But the way they heighten that by the end of the episode is just insane.
Yeah.
And of course, the way it brings up those questions about do particular experiences actually have meaning?
This
is real.
So I guess the answer is, it's interesting because throughout the show, but specifically in this episode, we see Rick acting like an asshole. I mean, we've seen him act like an asshole before, but in this episode, you know, he's making jokes about like a coworker railing his daughter. He's telling Summer that, like, oh, your opinion means very little to me. He's very flippantly talking about his daughter's failed marriage. And we just think of him as an asshole. But then after seeing not only what happens in terms of him reentering the new dimension and just not even giving a shit about his quote-unquote real daughter, whether it is or not, and the people that they left behind, it actually gives a little bit of context into why Rick is so distanced from everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And when he takes the fucking just beer out of the fridge and then just goes and sits down and just like he's watching TV, you know, that slumped position he's in after just killing himself or, you know, burying his dead body and his nephew. I mean, yeah, like there's not only is it awesome from Morty's perspective, but yeah, getting into Rick's mind, how he just truly does not give a fuck like that in a way that I don't think I've ever seen anyone not give a fuck in anything.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
So one of the big lines that people that at least in our videos, we've revisited a couple times, but I think that people often remember is when Morty. So right after they're about to bury their bodies, Morty says, "What about the reality we left behind?" And Rick answers, "What about the reality where Hitler cured cancer, Morty?" The answer is, don't think about it.
One of the best lines of the series, too.
It is, but I just want to spend some time breaking that down. So first of all, what about the reality we left behind? So Morty is saying, you know, what about your daughter? What about my dad?
Why don't you care about these people?
Yeah, and
that
then
we
he
know.
Says, "What about the reality where Hitler cured cancer?" What does that mean? It's just like, hey, I suppose. I mean, at least my interpretation is, it's just, you know, if you truly try to grasp the infinite nature of the cosmos, then you're going to come up with some really disturbing conclusions no matter what. So whether it's, you know, your actual biological mother that's been left behind in this hellhole or not, you know, once you open your mind to the infinite nature of the universe, all meaning is going to be nullified. So fuck it. Right? Like,
you know, it's kind of like a distinction between an emotional response and view to life and just this really dark materialism.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, if love is real as an emotional state, then Morty is missing his parents and family and friends that he loves. If all that matters is the literal material nature of reality, then who gives a fuck? They're the same arrangements of matter, just in a different place. So why worry about
it? It's just
a
chemical reaction, dude.
Yeah.
That compels animals to breed. So he says then, you know, the answer is don't think about it. So the question I want to pose is, what happens if we do think about it? Where does that lead us?
You get fucking depressed and sad and you want to just, you don't want to live. And,
but is
Rick
not?
Rick's a party animal. You know, he doesn't want to fucking deal with that shit, that burden, that baggage.
Yeah. Well, this made me think of a David Hume quote. I feel like such a fucking nerd. Like,
no,
I was thinking
that's
of David Hume. But there's
bring
this thing,
it in, baby.
This is wisecrack, baby.
Yeah, nerds. There's a thing in David Hume's Enquiries Concerning Human Understanding. And David Hume, Scottish philosopher, legendary drunk, fell in a river once and almost died. But true story. But he says in this book that there's two ways of approaching philosophy. There's like the practical way, where we just take what we see in the world and sort of validate our emotional responses and aesthetic experiences. Or there's the hyper-rational way, where we, and he's kind of thinking of like the Cartesian method. We try to make literal mathematical sense of everything. And he literally says at one point, the person that does the first kind of like easy and obvious philosophy, they can do their thinking, but then hang out and have a beer at night and just be a relaxed dude. The one that's obsessed with the hyper-rational one is going to fall into a deep state of melancholy and depression. So he talks
about.
But
does
that
make it any less valid, you know? Like,
no, that's why I think Hume's interesting here, because he'll say like, there's valid stuff from that method we should use, but he's basically like, if we just have this life, do you want to spend your entire life in a room by yourself feeling melancholy? Or do you want to kind of, in a certain way, accept like practical reality to enjoy
existence? It's like, in practice, this philosophy might fuck up your life. But that, to me, that's two different issues, you know, because there's whether, you know, there's the seeking the truth against everything, you know, it will set you free. And then there's how that affects your life and your psyche or whatever. That's
so in the last podcast, we talked a little bit about the desire to like willfully limit the amount of knowledge you accumulate in the world. And I guess we're kind of seeing Rick doing that. So at the end, he does grab a beer and just chill. And you know, like he says, it's like the reality where Hitler cured cancer. Don't think about it. And so I think that we see more to Hume's point. In a sense, Rick is doing the same thing.
Yeah, that's why I think it's interesting, because he's doing both. Like, he's the one that has the hyper-specific rational knowledge about how the world works. He's also the guy that can crack a beer and not give a fuck.
Yeah.
Whereas Morty's
he's considered all this
first.
Stuff before, and he's just like, you know what? It just helps if I just stop at some point.
Yeah, it's like this meta position that sort of takes both of the human positions into account and is able to manage both, where clearly Morty is incapable of managing both those things in an emotional way.
Well, I do find it interesting that we see him be completely devastated this time, but I think as the series goes on, Morty does become more desensitized. Yeah. I mean, he would have to. But I do like how, I mean, it's very rare that this show takes any kind of break from, like, you know, the constant, like, jokes, like 10 jokes per minute kind of pace, and actually just turns the dialogue off and really focuses on someone's experience. And that ending, the song at the end is so haunting.
Oh, my God.
When we just see Mazzy Morty Star. Looking around, looking at his parents arguing again, looking at everything seeming the same, and
just that numbness that it captures is so real.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, and then we see by the time season three happens, we have, for example, the Vindicators episode, Morty has, you know, dismantled multiple neutrino bombs from Rick's blackouts. So he's like so, I think that that Vindicators episode is one of the best examples of him being like Rick's knowledge and Rick's antics and all the very cold, rational aspects of the universe have kind of worn on Morty, and he kind of gets it now. This is him. This is like an essential turning point for Morty. And another thing about season three is that we saw in season three how Morty kind of becomes the adult of the season. He's always telling, you know, in the episode where Summer, like, makes herself grow too big, he's the one who's kind of telling Beth, like, stop fucking around, stop trying to prove that you're, you know, capable, trying to prove yourself against your dad, and let's just get this thing fixed. We see him always being the mature adult, and I think that this point is definitely a very fast, rapid coming of age for Morty.
In season three, what's the episode? Him and Summer, like, dig him up, right? Like they
dig, yeah, that was in the first episode. That's in the Rick Shank Redemption, because they have to get his portal gun out to save Rick from the Popo.
And doesn't he give Summer a version of the speech that Rick gives him in that episode, where he like explains the burying of the bodies and tells her to relax and watch TV?
I think that that's actually in season two. I think that that happens pretty soon after.
Okay, but at that point, he seems to kind of accepted that reality, because he says a similar thing to his sister.
Right. I also think that this is probably the first time in the series that we've seen, I guess, serialization in a sense. Like, it, I guess maybe not this episode. This episode definitely set the standard in that from ensuing episodes, they could have just ignored the fact that they switched dimensions, but they actually do bring it up, to Michael's point, later on, and it becomes a plot point. And then at the beginning of season three, they dig those bodies back up. So
the student becomes the master.
So let's move on and let's talk about Beth and Jerry's marriage. So I think this kind of goes into what we're talking about already, but for an episode that's very cynical about love, so there's the line where Rick says that love is just a chemical reaction that compels animals to breed. And then there's short lines like when Jerry says, when Jerry's giving Morty advice about women, he says, just wait until Brad's out of shape and then Jessica might care about nice guys. But I think ultimately Beth and Jerry's arc is pretty uplifting. And I think without that, this episode would be almost too dark, I think.
I think Beth's take on love is really interesting, too, at the point where they're talking about homeless shelters and stuff. And she says, you know, loving you is work. So she doesn't say that she doesn't love him, but she acknowledges that for her, love isn't a chemical reaction. It's sort of a decision and a type of work. I'll say this quickly when we get back to something else. But there's a philosopher, Alain Badiou, contemporary French guy. And he has a whole theory of love, has written a few books on it. But his theory of love is that love is just a decision that sets a bunch of axioms for someone's subjectivity. So emotion doesn't really matter in that context. Also, never tell your girlfriend that you're a Badouian on love. It doesn't play well. But so it seems like there's a through line in the Beth and Jerry story that advocates for that type of love.
I know you also have a background in some theology. Would you say that that syncs up with kind of earlier, almost Christian views on love, and that love was a duty toward God to procreate or to, you know, something like that? And it wasn't necessarily like we, in the West, in our more secular age, we tend to think of love as like something that fulfills us, something that's much more selfish in a sense.
Yeah, I mean, in like the Protestant tradition especially, love is associated with work. Soren Kierkegaard has a book that's just called Works of Love, in which love is a duty and it's something you do and it's something active. It doesn't really fucking matter if you feel good about it or if you get butterflies in your tummy.
Right.
It's something you do as a sort of commitment to others.
Right.
What about the Anne Hathaway tradition of love, where it's the only thing that transcends time?
Space and time.
Oh, yes. I love that tradition. It didn't transcend space and time in the one movie where she gets hit by a bus while riding a bicycle.
Which movie is that?
It's called
Sliding Doors?
One day.
Oh.
Watched it by myself at 4 a.m. once and started crying.
I thought you were talking about the movie with Anna Paquin. Isn't there like a movie with Anna Paquin where she...
Fly Away Home?
Someone gets hit by a bus.
I don't know.
It's a thing. You get to like page 130 of the script. Like, what do we do? Bus.
Yeah.
Sort it out.
So, yeah, I think more to Michael's point is that importantly, Beth does not want to hook up with Davin. You know, it's she actually does resist him in the, you know, before Davin gets infected with the Morty curse or the Morty disease and starts saying, like, how soft are his genitals?
That's one of the best scenes of the episode.
Yeah, but even though he's sexy and he's, you know, more successful than Jerry, you know, importantly, she doesn't want to hook up with him. And I think that, yeah, that's even before the apocalypse happens, I think we can see something, kind of idealistic about their love, even though they constantly argue, even though, you know, such and so forth.
Right.
So let's talk about how Jerry kind of, I think this is, once again, because we leave this dimension, we almost get a privileged look at the most fulfilling Jerry-Beth marriage arc.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, if we stayed in this dimension and, you know, we stayed in the post-apocalypse, now Jerry and Beth are totally in love and they don't have any more marital problems, well, that would kill a lot of opportunity for comedy, since so much of the comedy of this show is derived from Jerry just being a schlub and being just kind of like this alienated stooge. But Jerry becomes a man of action once the apocalypse happens.
How did that happen? How did he kind of become like Rambo all of a sudden?
Wasn't it like the jealousy? Because he says at one point, like, I'm not going to let any of you kill me until I find out my wife is cheating on me.
Okay, yeah.
It's not even like he wants to
know. It is
a
jealous rage kind of a thing, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, there's also that amazing line where after he kills Davin with a fucking crowbar, which is epic.
Mr. Crowbar.
He says... Or I think Beth says, oh, thank God. And he says, God's the person turning people into praying mantises. I'm the one who just killed them.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Well, Jerry also says something that I think is the funniest line in the entire series. I don't want to get ahead of it, but when he says that he wishes, what does he say? Says he wishes the shotgun was his penis. And Beth says, if it was, you could call me Ernest Hemingway. Which for anyone who doesn't know, Ernest Hemingway shot himself in the head with a shotgun. So she's saying she wants to be murdered by Jerry's shotgun penis.
Oh, just, wow.
The levels of that joke are just delightful.
Amazing. Yeah, that's a
and
great
then
one.
And Jerry doesn't get it?
No.
He doesn't have to.
Yeah. Right, but that's still funny.
Yeah.
I might be going a little bit too far on this, but I also like that. So
meta.
Also, no, not quite. But later in season 3, we see that there's this push and pull between, like, Beth is trying to decide, you know, do I go back to my husband or do I stay with my father, who is this genius that I feel like I have to prove myself to? And in a sense, you know, Jerry comes in with a fucking crowbar and says, you know, God, and although he's not really referring to Rick, but Rick is often likened to a god throughout the show. And in a sense, you can see in some sort of, I don't know, like, psychoanalytic matter, he is fulfilling, he is fulfilling the kind of... He's taking charge and taking that spot as the domineering father figure that Beth has this void for.
Yeah, he's the superego in that world, for sure, in the way that that God would be in a traditional sense, because he like structures the logic of so many of their like psychic lives.
Yeah.
So it makes sense.
Yeah. And in terms of the thing that Ryan was asking about, like, you know, how did he become such a badass quickly? I don't really think that this quite answers the question, but something that came into my mind is, like, everybody knows somebody who's like over-preparing for the apocalypse, right? Like, everyone's got a friend who's stockpiling guns and food and like has a boat and has an escape plan, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those people, I don't know. I think that this kind of highlights the trappings of our society. So, you know, we later see in season 3 that Jerry is only successful when he has this job at the Intergalactic Federation, in which he doesn't even know what he does. He basically does nothing. He crawls around, you know, trying to escape. And I don't know, like, those people who are over preparing for the apocalypse, like, they can't wait for it to happen. And why can't they wait? Because I don't know, like, I don't think Jerry is one of these people, but there is something to be said about there are people who fantasize about a world where you're now the top of the food chain. These days, being top of the food chain means, you know, being having a high level of proclivity for things that work within, you know, our capitalist system, whether that means emotional intelligence or, you know, aptitude at computers or whatever. But if you're like a badass who just, you know, has a really good aim and is really good at survival skills, don't you kind of want the apocalypse to happen?
Yeah. Well,
because you want to be at the on top.
Have you guys seen the clips from NRA TV that they showed on John Oliver last week?
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
Wait, is that a channel or a show?
It's a TV channel. It's like a streaming service. But like, they showed a bunch of the clips, and some of them are just dudes looking at the camera like, we will be attacked, and America will be taken down, and the police will not respond in time. So will you be ready? So it's this whole macho logic like that kind of appeals to that. People that want to be ready to take over when something bad happens and prove themselves.
Well, but they're looking forward to it.
Well, that's your point, but I don't think that that's the point. I think that your hardcore prepper people, you know, are way more into just like it's not that they are looking forward to, oh man, I can't wait to fucking just be able to, you know, it's going to be, yeah, just this post-apocalyptic society. It's more like they see all these problems in society coming up and bubbling up, and no one else is preparing, but like they are the smart ones that, you know, and it's going to be this big I told you so moment where it's
so
like,
they want to be proven right.
Yeah, they want to be proven right that like, oh shit, I didn't just spend, you know, 50 grand on this bunker under my house for nothing. I got, you know, a 10-year ration of food supply. Fuck all y'all. I think it's more of that.
Right. But I mean, even that inclination of wanting to be right, I think maybe these people feel like they're so rarely right in today's society that.
Maybe.
Okay.
Well, you could just invite a prepper. You'd like this room.
Hey, you know, I have nuclear reaction pills in my desk over there.
Really? What do they do?
If a nuke hits, then you take one and it makes your thyroid gland from not bursting when the radioactivity hits.
Did you order those from alexjones.com?
No, just from Amazon.
Okay.
It's a trusted place. Better safe than sorry, man. I'm just glad
that, you know, If the shit goes down, we've got Ryan in the office. Hey, he's got the pills.
I'm not sharing my fucking pills. I got 2 weeks.
All right, well, then we'll just kill you and take them.
Oh, boy.
Mr. Crowbar is going to have something to say about that.
All right, so I have a silly question.
All right.
So, you know, we have the classic line in this episode where Rick says, you know, Morty, I hate to break it to you, but what people call love is just a chemical reaction that compels animals to breed. It hits hard, Morty, and then it slowly fades, leaving you stranded in a failing marriage. I did it. Your parents are going to do it. Break the cycle, Morty. Rise above. Focus on science.
I love that.
My silly question is that, so, okay, Beth and Jerry, in that universe at least, their marriage does not fade. It actually, the opposite happens. It has this reawakening. And in an ironic sense, you could say that Beth and Jerry do break the cycle through science because it's because of Rick's scientific errors that allows the apocalypse to happen and then they get back together. So my silly question is Rick right? Does Jerry, I guess my question is, why do Jerry and Beth have that reawakening of passion? Is Rick right? Is it that they, because the human race is now almost extinct, they have more chemical incentive to breed? Or is it because something else is just that, you know, more to the psychoanalytic angle that Michael and I were talking about earlier, in that now Jerry kind of resembles the male father figure that Beth has been yearning ever since Rick left her mother?
Dude, I think it's the first one all the way. I think it's kind of a cynical take, like where basically Jerry and Beth are now happier now that the society has crumbled around them. You know, because like you're saying, they have a more of a chemical reaction to compelling them to read.
So it's just like
survival skills or serotonin in their brain. It's like, yeah, now, you know, like every moment to moment means something. I got this man that's going to protect me, you know, and it's like.
Well, that's more the second one.
Well, okay, yeah, but it's still the first one, though, because the survival feeds into that, you know, there's still...
I guess I would argue that even if the apocalypse wasn't happening, and let's just say that, I mean, if Davin didn't turn into a praying mantis and Jerry came in and killed him with a crowbar, assuming, you know, obviously killing him wouldn't be good because then Jerry would be in jail, I still think that that would reinvigorate their marriage is what I'm saying. Like, because Beth needs that godlike... masculine figure.
I think there's some truth to that.
Maybe to your point, though, it only works if, once again, he is a godlike savior, which wouldn't really work if it was just regular Davin.
But I think, right. I don't even think it's that.
Regular civilization.
Yeah. But I don't know if it's that Beth makes Jerry, like, the new father figure superego. I think with Rick being gone, it's the destruction of that logic in a certain way. So then it's no longer Beth thinking of Jerry as mediated through Rick. She can have a more immediate relation. Mm. And there's this, I don't think this is in the show, but you could also say that maybe it's kind of pointing out that society is terrible and makes love and true relationships really hard. So when society is destroyed and they can just kind of hang out, it's easier to relate as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, I don't think that's in the show.
No, yeah. I mean, like a lot of this is we're just kind of taking elements from the show as jumping off points.
And they never like say, hey, where did Rick and Morty go?
They say that. So they say.
What do they say?
And they don't care. It's funny.
Well, this is interesting because so it's when they find Summer after the whole Ernest Hemingway joke. He says, I wonder if Rick had something to do with that. And Jerry says, oh, well, it's not good to assume. And then Beth said, please, of course it was him. That asshole left my mother. Which is interesting to hear her say she left my mother, because I think people often don't have to often remember this, because there's a lot of people think that in the Szechuan sauce episode, that flashback or whatever, like the made up memories inside of Rick's mind of, you know, the Rick's wife being killed by something like that bomb. Some people are saying like, oh, maybe that is some sort of reflection of a true event. But Beth is saying that he left her, which makes it seem like it wasn't some sort of a tragic accident.
Right.
Yeah. But at that point, doesn't Jerry almost say after the credits, like, I wonder what Rick and Morty are up to. And then Beth like just says, who cares or something like that.
Yeah.
While Summer is performing the movie Jaws out of a cardboard box.
Yeah.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. Okay. Sorry.
Isn't she reciting one of the, what's the name of the guy that
Roy Schneider? Oh.
Probably. That Walter's based off of. The writer of Apocalypse Now. What's his name?
And Red Dawn, John Milius.
Yeah. Just in case, the John Milius.
Walter from Big Lebowski.
Right. Yeah. The John Milius, he wrote that monologue in Jaws. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So I think that's what she's reciting.
Nice. Right?
Yeah. So for those of you who don't know, the character Walter in The Big Lebowski is based off of this Hollywood writer / he is a nom vet, right? Well, I mean, he wrote Apocalypse Now named John Milius, who is an awesome writer and a kind of eccentric
incredible
dude.
Filmmaker. Red Dawn, I love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the last thing I want to bring up before we get into the mailbag is a lot of times we've had a couple emails of people asking us about the distinction between science and engineering, and people have said that, oh, well, Rick is more of an engineer because he uses science that has already been established. He doesn't do a lot of his own research. And because I have not revisited this episode that much, I have not cited this episode during that discussion, but I think that this episode is great proof of Rick as an as a scientist. Because I think he has one line that speaks a lot to the process of research and science. He says, a lot of times science is more like art than science, Marty. A lot of people don't get that. It's a great line, right? And that speaks to just the essence of creativity that that the scientific method does require that, you know, people don't often recognize.
Yeah. That's why philosophers get mad at scientists a lot. So we were hanging out with like douchebag science grad students.
Never have before.
Never do it. It's terrible.
Okay.
But they'll be like, well, we study reality and you guys just get to make things up. Is it nice writing a thesis on opinions? And it's like, you dumb. Can I swear?
Please.
Okay. Please.
It's like, you dumb fucks. Because they forget that everything they're doing is sort of an artistic exploration of these things that has so much room for error, that science is constantly revising its own conclusions. And good scientists would acknowledge that. It's just the grad students that can't hold their booze that are dicks about it.
Yeah, I think it was Existential Comics that has a great tweet that was, why is science important? And then someone starts answering. It's like, and now you're doing philosophy.
There was one joke I wanted to make sure we talked about.
Sure.
The principal's announcement at the beginning about
principal vagina.
Yes, when he says, you know, don't come to the dance if you have the flu because you don't bring dead babies to Passover.
Yeah.
I like rewound it and listened to that again and was just dying. And it's like underneath other people talking when he says it.
That was the first, I've probably seen this episode. This is probably my third time or fourth time seeing it. And I had never noticed that until this time.
Yeah. And we're approaching Easter. So I just figured it'd be good to be thematic.
Also, listeners,
doesn't that also mean we're approaching Passover? So, hey.
Well, that's what I meant.
Principal Vagina's voiced by a guy named Phil Hendry. And if you ever have a moment, if you ever have a long time, to go and listen to Phil Hendry's show, because he is my favorite artist of any kind, entertainer, I would say.
Is he still on?
He's still online. It's not as funny online, but his old AM FM his old AM show that was back on like, you know, early 2000s and stuff or even up till 2010, I think, around then, is so awesome. He plays characters. he basically has conversations with himself that are really obscene, and then callers who don't know that he plays all the characters call in.
He's the original troll.
So I didn't know that was him.
Fucking
that's
him. Amazing and smart and awesome.
Yeah, if I can just summarize what Ryan's talking about, you got to check out the Phil Hendry Show, because the premise is that it's a three-person talk show, except two of the people are just him. So he plays the host, Phil Hendry, and then he, you know, picks some kind of sensational...
Sometimes it's two people, sometimes one, but yeah, anyway, keep going.
He picks some sort of sensationalist news story and then invites a caller in, and it's crazy how the show had been going on for so long, and yet every single time someone calls in and doesn't understand the premise of the show.
Well, yeah, because there's enough old people or suckers or just people that just turn on their radios and they don't know what they're hearing.
So he'll be hosting and playing one side of the argument while there's a caller who's oblivious to the fact that he's arguing against the host and the other debater.
I think there's an episode of the show Marin that he's on. Mark Maron goes to his show, and like you see the whole thing.
And it was like an underground thing for a long time, and only recently has he become kind of a favorite in like now, like the Hollywood people have started to
all
recognize
the cool
him.
People like
him. Right. So
he plays the computer intelligence in Team America, the computer in their bunker.
Yeah. when Ryan and I first moved here, he introduced me to Phil Hendry. It's pretty amazing.
We also got to talk about David Cronenberg too.
One of Ryan and I's favorite filmmakers. For those of you who don't know, I think so. Basically, once after the praying mantises, then after the next antidote that goes crazy, they turn into these crazy abominations. And Rick says, "Oh, we really Cronenberg the world up, didn't we?" And Cronenberg is a filmmaker. He's made Scanners, The Fly, Videodrome. More recently,
Existence, Dead Zone.
Yeah, more recently,
Dead Ringers, Naked Lunch.
Yeah, those are all the movies that are probably more in terms of what Rick is talking about, because those are kind of his body horror days. These days, he most recently did
History of Violence.
History of Violence. What was the Freud Young movie?
Oh,
A Very Dangerous Something. Dangerous Method?
Dangerous Method. Eastern Promises.
Eastern Promises. What was the one
with the guy from Twilight?
He's made a Cosmopolis.
Cosmopolis, which is unfortunately
unwatchable.
But the
one afterwards, something about the stars.
Map of the Stars.
Map of the Stars is good. So he's very prolific. He's a Canadian filmmaker. But what Rick and Morty are referencing here is his body horror. He's one of the, I guess, the fathers of the body horror genre. Body horror meaning basically that it's just a subgenre of horror films in which the human body is distorted and things grow out of it and like, you know, bodies explode and stuff like that. And oftentimes it's been linked to ideas of like, the movie Videodrome, for example, is about how the video world or electronic media is basically changing the human identity. And so that's like explored metaphorically through, you know, pieces of metal growing out of the character's flesh. You can also see that in a really awesome movie that is really hard to find. I actually haven't seen that one, but I was going to say Tetsuo the Iron Man, which we've actually briefly talked about on our movie podcast. Body horror is a really awesome genre that doesn't really exist anymore. Well, you know, it was mostly the late 80s and early 90s.
If you haven't seen Shivers, dude, this Rick and Morty episode is straight up that, because it literally turns people, it's like this virus that turns people into sex craze maniacs. And they just all these people running around humping each other. It's pretty awesome.
I assumed the Cronenberg movie that I've seen that I think was most visually similar was definitely The Fly. Which, by the way,
just because of how their body looked.
Right. And by the way, I know that on the internet there are a lot of ironic Jeff Goldblum fans, but the role that he was born for is The Fly.
It's
so
amazing.
If you haven't seen The Fly, you got to see The Fly.
Why would you ironically be a fan of him? He's fucking great.
Is it not ironic? Has it gotten post-ironic?
I think it is.
He's great.
Yeah.
Okay. But is he great because, I mean, like, what good movie has he been in recently?
Well,
like,
the
Independence Day sequel was horrible.
Life Aquatic, he was great in that. I think he's done some other Wes Anderson movies. He doesn't need to do them often. He's busy playing at his jazz night.
That's cool.
Well, there was that thing that I had. It was like a picture of, it said Jeff Goldblum is watching you poop. You know, you ever see that? It would be in bathroom stalls.
I had it
in my bathroom for forever.
Nice.
I think that was that was everywhere. I feel like that was maybe his introduction to becoming a meme.
I think before that, like, wasn't Ernest Borgnine is watching you poop?
I don't know. I've never heard that.
I feel like I saw that one.
That would make me constipated.
All right.
And go see Crash. Anyway.
Oh, well, let me qualify that. See the 1995 crash. Oh, yeah, have you seen that, Michael?
The David Cronenberg crash. That's
no, I like the one with like Ludacris. The explorers the race one. In America in like a really cool
no,
way.
No, no, no. We're talking about the one that's all about
won an Academy
people
Award.
Having sex in car crashes.
It's about people getting in car crashes and then getting
I've
turned on
that.
And having. Oh, you have seen
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Did Cronenberg do that one?
Yeah.
You like it?
I didn't like it, but it's a movie that I watched and I knew that I needed to tell people that I had seen it. And then when they made a comment, I needed to be like, yeah, definitely. And then I probably watched Wedding Crashers
afterwards.
Well,
were those people that you need to say that?
Yeah, no, it's great.
I love that.
Great stuff. We love it.
No, I saw a fender bender on the way here. So, never mind.
You got a boner?
Is that why you were a little bit late? You had to pull
late
over.
And sweaty.
Yeah. Yeah, we were watching the episode. Me and my girlfriend were watching last night and Hannah didn't, she was like, who the fuck is what's a Cronenberg, you know? So I felt like we had to tell people, you know, that they didn't know who Cronenberg was.
I knew that you all were going to talk about this because watching it last night, I was like, I don't think I get that. Oh. I knew that y'all would, though.
Oh, well, I mean, you know, we know the Cronenberg, you know the Hemingway. Bam, bam.
Nice.
I knew both of those references.
All right, let's...
I'm cool. Keep going, Jared.
All right, let's go into the mailbag.
Yeah.
All right.
Do you have stuff picked out, Ryan?
Yeah, I got a couple of them.
All right, rock and roll.
Okay, so let's start off with Fink, who has some more Rick and Morty porn names. Let's get on the list. Show me what you squanch.
Well, the funny thing about that is squanch can mean anything. So, I mean, you know, my mind can go to very dirty places.
Beta 789. I don't really get that one. Mr. Poopy and Froopy Land.
That could potentially be very gross.
Girls Gone Cronenberg. That one's kind of funny. The Ricks Must Be Gay. That was in all caps at the end. And You're a Cute Little Top.
You're a cute little...
It says Summer explores her butch side when she visits Gazorpazorp.
Oh, because in the Gazorpazorp land, they're all saying, oh, your top is so cute.
Gotcha. Okay.
Oh.
Yeah.
Deep cut there. And then last one, I don't feel safe word. It says Rick's autopilot knows the rules, but doesn't know Summer's limits.
Oh, like from the episode, from your favorite episode, the Rick's Must Be Crazy.
Yeah. All right. Well, some of those are pretty good.
Please continue to send in your Rick and Morty porn names.
Yeah. Okay, so.
Wait, are they meant to be porn star names or titles of porn movies?
I think both.
Porn, we accept both, but it's been mainly porn titles is what it's been. This is a pretty long one, so I'm not going to read the whole thing, but here we go. From Joseph, Wubba Lubba, what's up, everyone? First and foremost, the ultimate Szechuan sauce question. Why in the hell doesn't Rick just make his own Szechuan sauce? To quote Rick himself, when I don't like something about the world, I change it. So why not change the world into having Szechuan sauce? Which leads, and then that's it. That's the excerpt I wanted to say.
Good question.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, maybe. Well, first of all, I feel like we McDonald's should qualify this that we did recently try the Szechuan sauce because now McDonald's is mass producing it, I guess, to take advantage of the craze. You had some too, right, Ryan?
I had a little bit, yeah.
And what did you think?
I liked it. I can see why Rick would like it. This is zesty and good. Jared, you did not like it.
I mean, it just doesn't. It's not as good as ketchup, not as good as, you know, pretty much. I can name a bunch of other sauces, barbecue,
or
honey
you
mustard.
Or just go to Chick-fil-A and have their sauces, which are superior in every way, shape, and form.
Right, I just feel like Szechuan sauce, there's a reason why they discontinued it. I mean, it's just like, first of all, I am willing to bet that no one on staff had the Szechuan sauce recently. It was like a random joke.
You don't think Justin Roiland had?
He maybe had it, but I don't even know if he liked it. It's just not that good.
Well,
it's very salty.
The reason they discontinued it is just because fucking Mulan went out of theaters. So there you go. Moving on to the next thing.
Yeah, but if it was good and it was drawing people to McDonald's, of course they would maintain it.
No, everyone loves McRib. They only have it like once a month.
Well, that's
or
because
once a year,
it's not economically viable.
No, that's not true. It's just because it's a marketing thing. You gotta whet people's appetites for it.
Yeah, you only have the Irish McFlurry. in March. You're not going to have that.
Oh,
in
Michael
Bitter
and song about the Irish McFlurry.
I mean, I think
Ireland, McDonald's cares about the Irish American community, and we stand for them.
To answer your question, Joseph, I do. I mean, you bring up a good point, but I do think that there's something about the rarity of the Szechuan sauce. He could have only had it during this one little 3 month period in the 90s, and so to Rick, that makes it rare and like a thing. I got I can't do it. McDonald's has to make it. And there's only a limited supply. Yeah. It's like diamonds.
Would you say that that's an ontological question? If it's like, even if it's the exact same thing chemically as the McDonald's Szechuan sauce, is it still the same? Even if you're able to make it?
Well, that's what I was going to say. I think like maybe this is getting at how we all have our own Szechuan sauce. Like some experience that even if it like could be replicated, it wouldn't be the same. Like, and in terms of, I don't know, like foodstuffs are a big one. We can replicate so many things these days. Or maybe it's like the touch of a lover and they die. And then someone's like, oh, I'm going to give you a sex robot that's just like your lover.
Right.
But there'd be something missing, that like minimal difference between the real thing and the replica. And well,
good point, because he does make a replica of his own daughter, you know.
Well, arguably.
Arguably. But the fact that he can do it means that he can do it pretty damn close.
Right.
And so
it's also like the knowledge, you know, it's like it's just knowing that this wasn't made by McDonald's, even if it tastes the same, just the knowledge, the bias is in your mind that when you're tasting it, I think there's some sort of subjectivity there that kind of taints the taste of the Szechuan
sauce. Or even just making it yourself. Like there's all those things where my mom makes these just real dank chocolate chip cookies that I used to get when I came home, but now I don't think she loves me that much. And at one point, I think I got the recipe and I did it exactly right, but it wasn't the same.
Yeah.
Because I did it and I got inside the sort of process of making them. I just wanted them presented to me.
Right.
In this special way where I didn't see the origin.
There's the love of your mother is baked into those cookies.
You don't want to see how the sausage is made.
In a mystical way.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, what's next?
That was a good one.
That was a great
question. So let's see. Next we have, this person's from China. Michael is from China. So
that's a traditional Szechuan name, Michael, that comes from a province. No.
Dear Wisecrack Dudes, I live in Qingdao, China. For some time, sorry, I fucked that up. And I have to take issue with your discussion on China's one-child policy in your last podcast. Two things. First, the policy failed to curb China's population. The Chinese Communist Party knew it failed after conducting an experiment using villages, some allowed to have as many kids as possible and some subject to one child. The population still grew at expected numbers as if the policy never existed. Anyways, not to bore you, the policy didn't reduce the population but led to lots of weird corruption, like officials seeking bribes from parents pregnant with a second child, forced abortions in a gender imbalanced country. More boys than girls. Second, China no longer has a one-child policy, and since December 2015 has had a two-child policy which still limits families. China also created another system to curb population growth and internal migration called the Hukou system. Depending on the city or town you were born in, you were restricted to live there. For example, if you're born in a rural village and your passport has rural on it, you can't access schools, hospitals, social services, or even legally rent an apartment in a third, second, or first-tiered city. So anyway, those are some relevant information to the one-child policy.
I really wish I remembered what we were talking about.
I mean, I know that...
Was it in our discussion about whether it was moral to have kids?
Oh, probably.
Yeah. Oh, it was. I think it was like, if you know the universe is meaningless and shit and collapsing, is it moral to bring children into the universe?
Then, we were also talking about your friend who is like a ecological philosopher. Yeah. So,
tenured this week.
Oh, congratulations.
Congrats, Anthony. He's never going to listen to this, but if he does, I'll seem like a good friend.
And you just gave away his name. Ooh.
Ooh.
Anyway, So I mean, I do not claim to be an expert on the one-child policy at all. And whether or not it worked, I guess, I mean, I'm sure Michael knows a lot more about it than I do. But I guess my point, I was just trying to suggest that the idea of would it be ethical to curb the population somehow, whether or not it's effective, like if in fact the world is in some sort of ecological crisis and unless we curb the population, there's going to be like, you know, a massive reduction in quality of life for all the inhabitants of Earth. Would it be ethical or not? And I'm not saying I think it is or isn't. That was just a question I was raising. But thank you, Michael, for clarifying that at least the efforts so far to do so have not been successful.
Yeah. I think we just brought it up anecdotally. So
yeah.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.
So this next one's from Math. More Rick and Morty porn names. Dick Potion number 9. I like that one.
Oh, that's appropriate.
Straightforward.
Close Encounters of the Dick Kind.
Are they all dick related?
But that wouldn't be Rick and Morty specific.
They're not all dick related. Dixie Vixness.
Okay.
Autoerotic assimilation. No changes needed there, he says in parentheses.
Okay.
Lick my balls.
Okay.
The Council of Dicks.
This is Rick and Dick.
All right, a couple more. One of my favorites is at the end. Blips and Jizz, Big Dick and Little Sanchez, and then my personal favorite.
That one's the best one.
My personal favorite, Principal Vagina Origins.
Oh, okay. That was worth it. I was really not enjoying these, but then that one I enjoyed.
Also, he says...
That reminds me of, like, Arkham Origins, and I would love to see the Principal Vagina Origins video game. I would like to see how he met Mr. Goldenfold, because in this episode, actually, if you guys remember, when Mr. Goldenfold is running after Morty, he says, Morty, me and the principal had a discussion, and we've decided that we're both insecure enough to agree to a three-way. Yeah. So I think that Principal Vagina and Mr. Goldenfold have... some kind of an intimate friendship that I think deserves to be explored further.
But
don't you think they were saying that under the influence of Rick Potion?
Yeah, but I mean, Mr. Goldenfold could have gone to any of the other teachers or,
maybe that was something that was in the unconscious anyway, and that Rick Potion just brought it to the forefront. I'm going to choose to believe that.
That's the thing about Rick Potions is they bring to the fore some of your most inhibited desires. Yeah.
Also, Math had this, another funny tidbit. It said, I would also like to point out the definition of Swiftie in the Urban Dictionary.
Oh.
And it is getting crazy horny at parties and or clubs, usually while extremely high, typically involves taking off your pants and your panties and shitting on the floor.
the last part, it has, justification in the text, but where did they come up with the first part?
I don't know. I'm just reading what Math sent from Urban Dictionary.
Yeah.
I found.
See, that's proof of the death of the author.
I mean, unless Justin Roiland typed that in there.
Yeah, that's also possible.
Yeah. That was my last one.
Cool. All right, everyone, I want to thank everyone for listening. I want to, again, ask everybody that if you enjoy this, if you enjoy what we do, please make sure to check out Wisecrack Plus. Just to remind you guys again, as a member, you get access to ad-free versions of our content, member exclusives, including interviews with our writers and researchers, such as Dr. Nihilism here, access to our full library of scripts and research, member-only Discord chat server so you can talk to us. I'm unfortunately addicted to my phone, so I'm on it like all the time. Opportunities to participate in our podcast like this one, which we're going to be launching soon. I'm really excited to get to talk to you guys. Exclusive Wisecrack merch every quarter and a whole lot more. Also, if you have a second, please check out our listener survey. It really helps us succeed more as a company. And finally, I want to let you guys know that we have some awesome new podcasts in the works, including one on anime, one on Westworld, a debate show. I'm actually talking to Mr. Burns here about doing one on music, since he's kind of one of our resident music dudes.
I listen to music, yeah.
Yeah. And also, we're testing something on personal finance with our man, Ryan.
Wow.
Ryan has actually shot, just to let you guys know, he's actually shot a little bit of a test of his finance show, and I'm very excited about it, so we hope to launch that soon.
Oh, yeah.
Until then...
Where can we find you on the internet, Mike?
Youporn.com/... my Twitter, it's like Michael O. Burns is my Twitter name. The username is a little more convoluted than that. Just that for now. If you find me, friend me and let's chat.
Jared?
You can friend me on Facebook. People have been doing that. Just Jared Bauer, B-A-U-E-R, or follow Wisecrack on Twitter, @Wisecrack.
Hey, you can friend me on Facebook too, Ryan Haley.
Aww.
Or go to Ryan's game show on YouTube, and that's all. Ryan Shorts, too.
No one friend me on Facebook. I would delete you immediately. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm starting to be a little bit concerned that it's going to reach a point where people start friending me just to, like, talk shit at me, and then I'm just going to have to, like, delete my Facebook.
100%. That's what's going to happen, so.
Yeah. All right. Well, that about does it. Thank you, everyone in YouTube for tuning in. Thank you, everybody on whatever podcast thing you're listening to. We're now on Spotify.
Oh, wow. Fuck yeah.
Fucking it's finally.
It's great.
All right. That's enough from us. So, everybody, thank you for listening and squanch you later.
Wubba wubba dub dub from Hollywood, California.
Wow. That's good. That's good. Bye.